First, come with me for a stroll in Sydney. Let's go down beside the harbour, down to the concrete concourse where the ferries plough up the sea beside us. Now, suddenly, around the bend, the most magnificent set of sails appear. It's Jorn Utzon's wondrous building, completed in 1973 after a tormented political and architectural process. Of course, the great man himself never saw the Sydney Opera House. But we all know it now as one of our most wondrous places, if initially a little acoustically compromised. If you've been lucky enough to go there to see a performance, it's a truly magical experience. And we're about to meet the CEO, Louise Herron. Let's repair now to her corner office for a cup of tea, shall we? Did you choose this as your office, or is this the office?
No, this is the office. And quite often we have international visitors and fabulous performers, and they come in here and they say, "This must be the most beautiful office in Sydney." And I say, "Why do you say Sydney? Show me a better one anywhere. It's the best office in the world."
We have a deficit in that this is radio. Describe what we're seeing.
So, first of all, the Opera House feels like being on a ship. I've never actually been on a ship, you know, on a cruise or anything, but you just look over here and you think, oh, that's the bow of the ship that I'm looking at now. We look over the top and you can quite often see ferries going past. You can feel the rumble of the ferries, particularly the Manly ferries. You can see the bridge. You can see the climbers on the bridge. You can see the flag, so you sort of know, you know, who might have died if you missed it on the radio, for example. And then the light changes throughout the year. Because we're facing due north, the light, particularly in the spring and autumn, is just absolutely amazing. Not so much today, as it's a bit of a grey day. But the light you can see is unbelievable.
Is there a favourite time of day?
Yeah. Around sunset is phenomenal. And the other thing is during the summer we had yoga and fitness on the steps at sunrise, overlooking the water. Oh, that was beautiful. Sunrise and sunset are the best times.
And does place finally make a difference to who you dare to be?
Yes, of course it does. Place makes a big difference about who you dare to be.
How do you deal with the BS involved in a bureaucracy? Any tips?
So one of the very first things that I did when joining the Opera House, so I joined in August 2012, and I said to Kim Williams, who was then the chairman, what I want to do at the annual strategy day is to present the strategy. So we spent 6 months basically working on the strategy, you know, listening, talking to people, what is important. And my tip for dealing with the difficult moments, because there always are difficult moments, is to have a really clearly articulated vision. Our vision is to be as bold and inspiring as the Opera House itself. And so that's the touchstone. Is that bold and inspiring? If yes, we do it. If not, we don't do it unless it'll lead to bold and inspiring. And then we have a mission, and our mission is twofold. And each limb of the mission is equally important. The first is to care for and renew the Opera House for future generations of artists, audience and visitors. And the second is to inspire and strengthen the community through everything we do.
That's terrific. And we just walked up the forecourt and it is bold and inspiring every single time, as I'm sure it is when you come to work.
Yeah, but hang on. You walked across the forecourt,
yeah.
And were there any cars?
No.
Have you ever seen it like that before?
No. Thank
exactly.
You.
Exactly. What we need to do is to look at it and say, hang on, fresh eyes. What could we do that's better? We don't need taxis and cars driving across the forecourt. We used to have 1,000 heavy vehicle movements a week across the forecourt, all the sets and the food and beverage and the garbage, and they now come in at the roundabout and go straight down. And then we said, what else can we do to make it clear So now there are no trucks and no cars other than some for accessibility. And it makes a tremendous difference. And when, you know, we first started talking about this, I noticed there was a lot of eye rolling, like, oh no, here she goes again. Yeah, here she goes again. We're going to do this. We are going to make this forecourt the most brilliant place. It's going to be like St. Peter's and St. Mark's and the great places of the world, because that's what it deserves to be. Not a car park. So let's go.
And can I put it to you that when international visitors, when visitors from around Australia and in Sydney come here and they find that beautiful uninterrupted forecourt, much like something they'd find in Rome or, you know, among the great cities in the world, they don't think, that Louise Herron, she's nailed that. But if they find the building doesn't live up to their expectations, they say, where's that Louise Herron? I want her head on a plate.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think that is such an important thing, because when you think about it, we're the temporary custodians of the Opera House, and that's the opportunity, that's the honour, but that's also the obligation. And so what we do is to think of this place, like for 40,000 years, it was a gathering place. It was a sacred place to the Gadigal people. And the idea that they used it for celebrating and singing and dancing, which is something that we're trying to, you know, absolutely continue with the lighting of the sails and so on. This is a massive, long-term effort, and we're just the temporary custodians doing what we can to make the most of this magical place.
And it's thankless in the sense that you won't be thanked if you get it right, but you'll be blamed if you get it wrong. I mean, that's my take on your job. It doesn't speak to an enormous ego.
This job is not about ego. Look at the Opera House. I mean, that's pretty...
You'd never take it on. You'd always be outclassed.
Oh, exactly. Who's going to take that on?
Now, the other thing is, if you stop looking at the magnificence of what Utzon's created here, what you see is what anyone in any country town... or any little city anywhere in Australia will see, which is a hall. And what do we know about halls? What does every mayor in Australia know about halls? That if you don't pour a lot of money into them, they kind of fall down. So to what extent is your job just to be a permanent professional beggar to get enough dollars together to ensure that it doesn't fall down? Well, it's not going to fall down, but it's up to scratch.
I love that question, because... it's actually, I think about something completely different. I think it's all about relationships. So when I first started, we brought together a group of philanthropists called the Idealists. And these were people who would work with us as our advocates, as our advisors, to sort of say, yes, you know, we get it. The Opera House really does matter. And idealism is what'll take us where we want to go.
Hang on. Idealism is just getting them to the table so that you can fleece them for all their money.
No. It's not, because they come and they have these great ideas about it. Lucy Turnbull, for example, who's one of our idealists, said, you're really missing a trick because you are not celebrating the Indigenous history of this place. Now, other people might have said that, but we really now are just... totally understand what she's saying. So then we have this group of 100 people, all of whom are renewing as idealists, and it's great. We had a fabulous function
and giving you money.
And giving us money. And at the same time, the New South Wales government gave us $13.7 million a couple of years ago to do a plan for the transformation of the Opera House, to prepare it for the next generation. And we did that plan, and within 6 months of starting the plan, we were given $200 million by the New South Wales government. They so understand the importance of this building, the importance of not letting it fall down, and its importance as the symbol of modern Australia. But then we have all the other things that we do, like Vivid Live, for example, to bring people in and to say the Opera House is absolutely relevant and there is something here for everyone, whether it's the baby's proms or Max Richter or the ACO, the opera, the ballet, the Bangara. It's this fabulous microcosm of inspiration and creativity. So when I arrived, this back wall of my office was covered in shelves. And I went to Denmark and looked in Denmark, and they just strip everything back to the core, you know, and back to this bare wall. And you'll see lots of walls like this around the Opera House, where you can actually see little pieces of, you know, little bits of concrete and bubble and cement. And I thought, you know what? What we need to do is take the shelves down. And then the other day, I was down in the facilities office, and I saw on the wall these things, which is a selection of the 160 manganese bronze extruded shapes produced for the Sydney Opera House.
And so this is a diagram that shows the metal people how to make every door handle, every handrail, every tread support, the whole thing.
Exactly. And then there's this one down here which shows the shape of the louvers and the sliding windows for the drama hall and the window glazing. As you go around the Opera House, you see these are the only shapes, and I never knew that there actually was a board that set all of this out. So what we're aiming to do across this wall is to put all sorts of representations of the Opera House. We're going to have a great big one of this year's Vivid Indigenous Sales. We're going to put up a Max Dupain photograph. We're going to put up, all sorts of things.
But Louise, look at this. Utzon has a vision not only for the sails, Utzon has a vision for the tread support under your feet as you go up the stairs, for what the handrail will look like. And all of this has been realised, but his interiors haven't.
Mm, that's right.
Famously, within 5 minutes, you'll always get to what's Utzon's vision and to what extent has it been realised. Mm. And I have noticed, Louise, that since Gough and Margaret have left us, you're missing something here at the Opera House. We would get to the Opera House and there would be Gough pontificating and there would be Margaret banging her stick on the floor, towering above everybody in the foyer. And now that they're gone, God bless them, all we're left with is granite. And I do wonder about your interiors. Is there a vision for those?
Yeah. So... That's the tea, not a we. So Utzon had a vision for the interiors. In fact, downstairs, you know, as you enter what is the vehicle concourse, as part of our plans, one of the things we're going to do is to convert that area into a great big undercover welcoming place. What Utzon wanted to do was to have a massive Picasso and a massive Matisse down there. And what we're going to do is to put digital art. There'll be more digital art at the box office level, and also, importantly, he had said that he wanted to use all these great artists. So Utzon contacted Le Corbusier in 1960, just after he'd won the competition, way before any of the dispute. And he said, "Will you, Mr. Corbusier, do something that will decorate the interiors of the Opera House?" And this fabulous tapestry that was intended to do that, we actually brought together a group of philanthropists last year and bought it from the Utzons.
So it had been made for the interior. Where had it ended up?
This particular one, there are apparently six copies of it, but this particular one had ended up in Utzon's dining room. So we had to get it cleaned. We had to get all the gravy and 50 years of Danish dinner off the tapestry. It wasn't very dirty, but I love the provenance. So the interiors are really important and part of our $200 million worth of renovations, plus another $75 million that we're funding ourselves. Part of that looks at the interiors. However, it is World Heritage listed, so what we can do is somewhat limited.
He had a vision of these metallic interiors, these grand sort of interiors, and very different from the kind of the brutalist concrete that is the inside, which is in itself lovely because you can see the anatomy of the sails from the inside. So it's something different has been produced. But is there something worth aspiring to in terms of his original vision?
Look, he says as times and requirements of the day change, so the Opera House needs to change. So, you know, I think it's really important to respect and deeply look at all of those things that were there in the past, but we need to make sure that we spend the money in the best possible way. So everything is looked at and then we come up with a renewal plan. Redoing the interiors, I have to say, is not as important to
I can see you're disengaged from this line of questions.
Let's say, accessibility and safety and, you know, people crawling through the ceiling and risking shorts all over the place. You know, it needs to be safe.
And in terms of who can perform here, mm-hmm. do you imagine it could be the sort of place where, you know, the brave, poor, cutting-edge, hand-to-mouth, project-by-project funded mob yeah. could have the stage for a week or a month?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is the problem is it's weirdly, for a place with seven venues, is how difficult it is to get a venue. You know, because the symphony and the opera and the ballet and the resident companies use the place so much of the time. So, yes, that is possible, but number one, it's getting the space, and number two is it's expensive. And we always need to make sure that we're fair, that from a pricing perspective, it's fair. So we don't charge someone more or less than anyone else.
But what have you learned about how people relate to this building? In the last decade, let's say, it's become a canvas for people's ideas, that they can throw a light display up for autism, or they can throw lights onto it and make it mean yeah. something else, which is a lovely metaphor, isn't it, for a stage. How are people's understanding of what the building is, or how yeah. they relate to it, has that
yeah.
changed?
Yeah, I think that it has changed a lot. And people had, I believe, as you're implying by your question, come to take it for granted, because there was massive excitement when it was first opened. And then it sort of went to sleep a little bit for a while. And it wasn't sure where it fitted. I think in the late 80s and the early 90s, no one really knew so much where it fitted. And then it came alive again, I think, about 10 years ago.
Hmm. And what happened to change that suddenly people wanted to wrap their arms around it and flash their virtual torch at it?
You know, internationally, like if you say you're from Sydney, people say, oh, Sydney Opera House. You know, it is the symbol of Australia. And people have come to recognise that. And our research shows that the brand Sydney Opera House is more valuable than brand Australia. Mm. It's the thing by which we define ourselves nationally and internationally. In preparation for the 40th birthday, we had it valued by Deloitte, and Deloitte valued the Opera House at $4.6 billion.
Why did you do that? Was that one of those insurance claims? If this burnt down, what would you need?
That's the cultural value. That's $2.3 billion if it burns down. But what is the cultural and social value of the Opera House to Australia? $4.6 billion.
Oh, so an executive doesn't have that bit of work done just out of curiosity for the answer. Why did you have that bit of work done?
To show people that it matters. It's a miracle that exists. It doesn't... There's nowhere in the world. You know, when I go to Denmark, the Danes say, we're just so thrilled that the Opera House is in Australia, because it never would have been built in Denmark. It's the symbol of Australia, because it is bold and innovative and courageous and all the things that we are as a nation. And I think that's why we love it, because it does in some way represent us. And I always think what an extraordinary thing it is that Australia is represented by an artwork. That's not what you would imagine.
Why do you go to Denmark so much?
Because of the Utzons, you know, because always going back to our history and ensuring that we're really being true to the original Utzon vision. And then obviously it's international, you know, and the idea of this kind of international collaboration which created the Opera House in the first place needs to continue. We need to be open to the rest of the world. We need to ensure that we have, you know, the best designers and the best possible input and international interest in what we're doing, because, again, that makes renewal possible.
And what are they interested in? Giving you money? Or I mean, that's surely that's in the back of your mind. Hello, how are you? Please give me all your money.
Do you want a relationship?
Of course, the relationship. I'm so sorry. You think about the possibilities that the virtual world provides for people to visit the Sydney Opera House. Mm. And on one hand, you think, well, that's ridiculous. Mm. I mean, the only way to experience the Sydney Opera House is do what we just did, walk in. Mm. But you have done something interesting there, where you've really tried to say there's got to be a way that you can experience this building without being here. Yeah. That's tricky.
Look, I think seeing it digitally just makes you want to be here even more. And for example, when Vivid started, we did the first live stream ever of the sales, on our Facebook page, and we've had a million views. It was the most successful ever Google live stream in Australia.
So just describe, Vivid is a light festival and cultural festival in Sydney, and as part of it, the sales are lit up. Now, what are a million people so desperate to see when it goes live on Facebook, or what were they desperate to see?
They're desperate to see, as you said, Ellen, you know, the canvas. It's an artwork that is a canvas. I think people understand the dimension of here you have an artwork that you're using as the canvas to display further artwork. You know, it's a kind of meta artwork.
Now we should turn to you. You grew up in Brisbane in the 60s for a bit.
Yeah. I lived in Brisbane from when I was 7 until I was 11, so okay. not that long. And then I went to school in Switzerland. I went to a French-speaking boarding school in Switzerland because my father was working in Italy and he was travelling around, and my brothers were still in Brisbane, and I apparently said that I really wanted to learn French. And so they sent me to boarding school where I was for 3 years and did all my schooling in French and German. And I then went to school in England, and I then finished off school in Melbourne. And then I came to university in Sydney. I love change.
For some little girls, that would have been horrifying. What did that education mean for you?
To open your eyes when you're 11 years old to go and live in a totally foreign culture and just land there, and I didn't speak any French, and just start doing, you know, French history in French and Swiss Confederation in German. You know, it was phenomenal. And being at boarding school, and there were 70 boys and 4 girls at the school, so, you know, it was quite an experience. And I had brothers, and now I have sons. So I have grown up, and I've worked as a lawyer and an investment banker. So I have sort of had quite a male upbringing, you might say.
In my notes here, it says that you nearly died of septicemia some time back. What happened? Yeah.
This was 4 years ago or so, just when our younger son was doing the HSC. So I'd been chair of Belvoir for 10 years, and at the same time, my husband and I had our own firm. And we were doing lots of corporate transactions, and I always really enjoyed the transactions, but I loved being the chair of Belvoir, and I loved the fact that, you know, all of the discipline and the clear thinking that you need to apply to being a lawyer or banker of any kind, that equally applies to running a little theatre company in Surry Hills. I wasn't running it, but to, you know, the same sort of philosophy and vision applies. And I got really sick. I had a kidney infection. I didn't pay any attention to it. And my brother's a doctor, and I said to him, I'm feeling like this. And he said, go to hospital, you've got septicemia. Diagnosed me over the phone. So I went to the hospital, and sure enough, I did. And the doctor said to me, you're 4 hours away from dead. You know, people talk about these blinding moments, and I just had a blinding moment that I'm only going to work on things where I really care about the subject matter, and I want to work in the arts. So my husband said, okay, I'll give you a year.
What, to come to your senses?
No, a year to find something that would be adequately rewarding.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense of, I'm sure you can imagine, you know, how challenging and inspiring this is. And I think that, you know, you want to make sure when you transition to something that it really grabs your interest. And so he was just concerned that I do something that was, you know, that had as many tentacles as possible. And this has certainly got hundreds of tentacles.
Sarah Ferguson has given me some... You should worry. She said she has a great laugh, which you're demonstrating now. She's a great wit with an enormous mind, who thinks that fun is going to Germany for holidays and doing a refresher in advanced German.
Yeah.
That's
me. I love that. That was actually...
What,
that
conjugating was, German verbs?
Oh, there's nothing I love more. I cannot... Really, I can't tell you how exciting I find. Whenever we go to Germany, I actually can't sleep for the first week because I'm so excited about compound nouns and, you know, the upper level of the library stairs being one compound noun, you know. I just love that.
You love that about it. You know, there's a lot of people who don't like German. They don't like German because of the Führer and what he did with the language. Mm. What's German for you?
It's like Bach. You know, as you walked in, there was music playing. I have music playing all the time, and music that sort of, and particularly Bach, I find, have basically every piece of Bach that was ever written and several recordings of some, because listening to that puts that incredible structure in your mind. And what I love about German is the structure and the sort of multi-dimensional structure, layer upon layer, which is just like listening to Bach.
Mm. Of the culture.
Of the culture.
Yeah.
I have to say, you know, I was really, really fortunate to have this upbringing that I had, where, because it happens to children in Europe everywhere speak, you know, many languages. To us it seems unusual, but in Europe it's not at all unusual. But the year before, during the G20, the leaders came to the opera house. So actually being able to walk around with Angela Merkel and speak to her in German for 40 minutes as I showed her the opera house, and then seeing what an incredible woman she is, and then going into the ballet rehearsal room, and she went up and she spoke to the dancers who were rehearsing, and then speaking with Renzi, the Italian Prime Minister, and then François Hollande came, and just the whole microcosm of bringing the world to the Opera House is something that I just absolutely love.
Mm. That's a good day. What's a bad day? Is it the worst prima donna? Is it the stroppiest plumber? What is the worst day? Is it when it leaks?
Yeah, that's pretty bad when it leaks. Look, in any organisation, the thing that is the most challenging, I guess, for the CEO is the culture. And so actually ensuring that we have a culture where everyone is focused, where everyone knows exactly what we're doing, and where we're all heading in the same direction.
And how do you do that? There'll be leaders listening, whether they're leaders in their own community or leaders in business. Yeah. I mean, I could ask you, what's your leadership style? But how do you do that? How do you bring people along on that project when they go, I've been here for 30 years, she oughtn't put a lift there, or I know, or I have that sense of ownership, which you say is terrific. It is.
It is terrific.
But you're in charge.
Mm. Well, you got to make sure you have the best people. I don't know how you say this without sounding as if it's really glib, but it is so much a team effort.
It was so lovely to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Ellen.
Louise Herron, the CEO of the Sydney Opera House. I hope you enjoyed spending the morning in her office. I'm Ellen Fanning, and I'm with you for Life Matters summer season.